This is Paul Burnett interviewing Mr. Len Harris for the Global Mining and Materials Research Project of the Business Series. And it's February 14th, 2015. And we're here at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Denver, Colorado. Mr. Harris, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad you could come and speak with us today. And you've had a long and wide-ranging career that is ongoing. And I want to start back where you were born, and if you could tell us a little bit about growing up in Australia.
Yes, certainly. Well, I come from a mining background. Both of my grandparents were miners, immigrants to Australia. One was from Ireland on my father's side, and on my mother's side from Cornwall. In England, you know what Cornwall is.
Yeah.
And they immigrated to Australia about the same time in the late 1880s. My grandfather come from a place called Allahies in West Cork in Ireland, where in the early 1800s it was the biggest producer of copper in the world. Those mines shut down in the 1880s, and most of the miners went to Butte, Montana.
Really?
Others went to other places, but Butte has a great tie back to this place. I've been there. In fact, we just had last September an Irish gathering where people came from all over the world to that little town. But my grandfather went to Australia to work in the mines of a place called Charters Towers in the North Queensland. He went with his whole family. They had a big bunch of children. And my father was actually born in that town, Charters Towers. On my mother's side, the Cornishmen, they had been in Australia before. My great-grandfather went to a gold rush in Australia, and with two sons from Cornwall. They made some money from the gold rush. They made enough money to go back to Cornwall and bring out the rest of the family from northern Cornwall. But while he was there, he got killed on the farm. They had a farm there. So my grandfather went back to Australia with one of his brothers. And he didn't really do a lot of mining. It was more his father and his brothers that were in the mining. He worked a lot in the west of Australia as a sheep shearer, as riding horses, breaking horses for the Indian Army, and as a jockey. Anyhow, I was born in a small seaside resort, which is now a large city, on the coast called Yeppoon, which in the Aboriginal language means lake. I don't know where they got the name from, but there's no lake. The sea is there. But my grandfather had an entertainment hall there at a barbershop. Before the war, he was drawn back to the mining. The mine at Mount Morgan Limited, which had started in the early 1800s, the mine worked for over 100 years, very rich gold copper mine. The mine had been shut down because the mine had caught on fire. There was a strike. The company blamed the workers on the strikers that set the fire, and the union blamed the company. Anyhow, it was an underground mine. It was on fire, you couldn't work it. But then they started up again, I guess in 1934, when I was like 7 years old, we went there. And my grandfather opened a billiard room and a barber shop. Now that's where I did most of my primary education, secondary education at Mount Morgan High School, And then I went on into the technical college, like a diploma in metallurgy.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I hired on at the company at Mount Morgan Limited in an indentureship for 6 years. Now, it was a work-study project for 6 years to get my diploma.
Can I ask you about Mount Morgan Technical College? So it's the mining company's college, is that right?
No, it was by the government. It came under the government.
Okay.
Had nothing to do with the mining company.
Okay.
It was under the Queensland Department of Education.
Okay.
The diploma actually reads Diploma at the Department of Education, Queensland Department of Education.
Okay.
And they taught other things there too. Mm-hmm. But I was, at high school, I was very good at chemistry and math. And a friend of mine had already started on working at the company under the same conditions. And he introduced me and I got the job there. So I stayed there longer than that. I continued to work after I got my diploma in the mine. And they had two concentrators there and a smelter, proper smelter.
And the concentrators are doing beneficiation. Are they crushing?
Beneficiation. Yeah. Producing copper gold concentrates.
Okay. So they're using acids and things like that?
No, the smoke just went up the stack.
Okay.
In those days.
Okay.
Now, then came the war. Well, I turned 18 in July of 45. Right. I wasn't drafted in the army because it was considered to be a protected industry. Making copper, for the shells, for the ammunition.
Sure.
Well, as you know, the war finished anyhow in September 45. So I continued working there till 1951.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I went to Mount Isa, which was hadn't been opened too long ago. It was belonged entirely to ASACO. At that time, you heard of ASACO?
Yeah.
American Smelting and Refining Company.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to work there as an assayer and a chemist. But I really wanted to get out in the operations. So I got transferred to the mill as a mill ship boss.
You wanted to be in the...
I wanted to be in operations.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be a chemist. And I used to do the assaying for gold, a very hot place. Mount Isa, in those days, there was no air conditioning. You know, people talk about the good old days. I didn't find the good old days. Wherever I went, it was hot, very hot weather, temperature.
How did you describe off camera the temperature in one place being 138 degrees Fahrenheit?
You know, Mount Isa was in that range to 120.
How do you survive on a daily basis? In that?
No air conditioning. I stayed in the staff employees' house, company housing, you know, and they had their own canteen, their little food, lunch, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But when I worked a night shift, you know, I'd come off a night shift, it'd be 100 degrees in the morning, but I had a fan, and I used to wet the bed down, jump into the shower, get all wet, and jump into bed with the fan on me. That'd give me enough time to get to sleep.
Wow.
And, well, then after that, I was there for 2 years at Mount Isa.
Yeah.
And I got a letter from the Australian Economic Energy Commission offering me a job as metallurgical engineer in this place called Radium Hill.
Right.
It was owned jointly by the Australian Energy Commission and the U.S. Energy Commission. It was in those days when everything was kept quiet about producing uranium.
Right.
And I worked this in another very hot place in the middle of the desert in South Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And The guy who was the general manager there was leaving, so I left with him, and we drove to Melbourne, and I took a boat to Italy. It was in 1953, which was the year of the coronation of the Queen.
Right.
And it was very difficult to get any kind of transportation out of Australia. I first booked on an American ship, Matson Line, which bumped into the wharf in Sydney and sank. That was a time when there was a lot of immigration from Italy.
Yeah.
60,000 Italians a month were immigrating to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them had been there previously in prisoner of war. The north of Australia is very hot country. A lot of sugar cane growing there, and papaya and pineapples, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And originally in the colonial days, before 1901, it was worked by the natives from the Melanesian Islands.
Right.
In 1901, Australia got their semi-independence from Britain.
Right.
And they wrote the horrible thing, and the Constitution was called the White Australia Policy.
Hmm.
Only whites were allowed in the country, so they deported all these Melanesians, and they began to bring in Italians.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Italy was in a bad way at that time,
right.
You know, just after the war.
Right.
And a lot of them had been there, prisoner of war camps,
right.
Near where I come from, in fact, because the whole population was very big, Irish and Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And they began to work cane fields. They became quite rich out of this, too.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when I went back to Australia after I'd been away 18 years, I thought I'd like to go into this business, cane, sugar cane. So I went with my wife, but it was just impossible to buy the land now because people were making so much money out of it. So,
when were you considering getting into sugar
cane? Queensland.
What, when, though? What year?
I went in 50, well, when was I there?
53?
I came back from, yeah, in 53.
Mm-hmm.
I was a metallurgical engineer. And from there, I went on to Ghana. We're not crushing Ghana yet, no?
We haven't, no, not yet. And you mentioned you were married at that time?
Yes, I got married in, I went to Peru in 1955. I got married in 1957.
Okay.
It's 58 years ago.
Yeah.
Same woman.
That's
a long time, huh?
That's a story in and of itself.
She couldn't speak any English,
mm-hmm.
nothing. But I could speak some Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been there a couple of years. I was there on contract.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And 57, I got married, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to that. So, you mentioned that you were briefly at the Radium Hill project. In Australia, you were a metallurgical engineer just during 1953, and you said that this was kind of hush-hush. Was the knowledge of the project kept secret?
Yes, it was, very much.
You were asked to...
We were kept in a camp, surrounded by barbed wire.
Right.
And they had Geiger instruments, which would read the amount of uranium.
Yeah.
Coming in the plant, going out in the concentrate.
Yeah.
And that was all locked up even from the shift bosses.
Right.
It was a very rare metal.
Yes.
Mineral.
Yeah.
Called davidite,
mm-hmm.
which was uranium, titanium, iron oxide.
Hmm.
Titanium iron oxide is a mineral called ilmenite. And this deposit, it was a mix of ilmenite and davidite. And it would react the same in the plant, in the heavy media plant, and in the flotation plant, with or without uranium.
Mm-hmm.
So you think you're making a very nice concentrate, and the boss comes in the next day and reads the Geiger counter, and there's no uranium in it.
So it was tricky for separation.
Very tricky, because you couldn't see. If we could see the Geiger counters, we would know. And you there was no uranium.
So you were flying blind?
Flying blind.
In your metallurgical work because of the secrecy?
Yeah. Only the superintendent had access to that Geiger counter, which assayed for uranium.
That must have made it a lot more, a lot less efficient to...
Oh, yeah, very much.
Because
that's the government, of course. Yeah? That's working for the government, yeah? Yeah. And we worked there only 5 days a week. They shut the plant down weekends. And so it wasn't all that far away from one of the big mining centers in Australia called Broken Hill.
Yeah.
So I used to go over there every third weekend. I had 4 days off. Mm-hmm. Well, I came off shift Friday morning, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and went back to work on Monday afternoon shift every 3 weeks. So that was a good break from there.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, there were 200 of us working there at that plant, in the mine. All men, but just one woman, the nurse. But I had this chance to go to Ghana, an industry that I knew better than uranium, gold.
Yeah.
Although later on I was exposed to uranium here in the United States.
How did you learn about the opportunity in Ghana?
Through a friend of mine.
Yeah.
Who had worked also working there at Takarabaso. Mm. And I said, you know, here we are, shift boss. And this meeting I talked about with the general manager of Mount Isa. We were shift bosses, and most of us were in our middle 20s.
Right.
But there was one guy there, 50 years old. Mm-hmm. He came from a very good school, mining school in Australia, in Ballarat. Had good experience in Fiji. He's still working as a shift boss. I said, my God, is that what I got to look forward to the next 30 years? Anyhow, the superintendent I knew very well because he came from Mount Morgan. And he had two assistants. And one of them was my age, mid-20s. And he was assistant superintendent. I said to him, how come here is Joe Blow there, 50-odd years old? It was a big problem in Australia, frankly, to get people to go and work shift work all their life, mm-hmm. you know? A lot of people were leaving the industry.
Right.
But anyhow, he said, you've got to get out of Australia. He said, I went for 1 year to Canada and the U.S. I didn't learn any more there than I could learn in Australia, but I came straight back as assistant superintendent. Got to get out of the country.
Right.
That was the way it was in those days.
Right.
Still very, I would say, colonial thinking, you know?
As a Canadian, I completely understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Come to the States to make it.
So that's why I decided, a couple of my friends, they went to Canada. And I got into a situation with a young lady. She's Finnish, you know, a big Finnish population there. I liked her quite a lot, and my mother liked her very much. But I wasn't ready to get married. So I left there, I went to Radium Hill, until I could get away out of Australia.
Right.
And that's why I left. Mm. I left on the ship, which was called the Castel Felici. It was backloading from the immigrants.
Right.
There were so many Italians entering Australia that they had the Sydney Morning Herald had a competition for the typical Australian. Somebody wrote in and said, well, he has to be Italian, because there's more Italians than anybody else in this country. And indeed, I mean, hundreds of thousands went from Italy. They were, you know, Italy was in bad shape.
That's
economically.
Right. Sure.
They didn't care about the heat of North Queensland or having to work hard cutting cane.
Mm-hmm.
And they became very prosperous because they started off working, it was just workers.
Right.
They were brought to Australia on a 2-year contract,
right.
Paid £5 to go.
Hmm.
But they had to go where the government ordered them to go,
right.
Where they needed labor
right.
in Australia.
Right.
Quite a few of them came also to work in Mount Morgan in the smelters there, and Welshmen too,
yeah.
in the mining end of it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, where are we now?
Well, people that I've spoken with have talked about these mining families, the Cornish and the Welsh,
yes,
and the Irish are very prominently represented in these generations of miners worldwide.
And
the Cornish especially.
Yeah, true.
So it's interesting to hear you talk
about. Well, I say my background is Irish Cornish, but there were a lot of Welsh also.
Yeah.
Because they were miners in Wales, you know?
Right, exactly.
I'll tell you a little side story about this. It's kind of interesting. They were very short people, and they spoke their own language, Gaelic.
Yeah.
They didn't understand a word what they were saying. They turned around to speak to you in English. Might as well just carried on in Gaelic, because they had such a broad accent. Yeah?
Right.
But they were good miners,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So they mostly went in. And the other ones are good miners in Australia too, which came in great quantities with the Finns.
The Finnish?
A lot of Finns, mm-hmm. Yeah. Like in Canada. So
right.
They were mining in Canada.
Right.
And anyhow, that's...
So you ended up in Italy briefly, but you had found out about this opportunity in Ghana. Did you go directly from Italy to West Africa after that?
No, I was on my way to West Africa. The ship just pulled in Italy.
Okay.
It was an Italian ship.
Uh-huh.
And that's as far as I could get getting out of the country.
Right.
As I told you, the ship sank, mm-hmm. and everybody was taking all the other transportation by air and ship for this coronation of the present queen.
Right, you know? Right. 53.
And so I had to wait quite a while to get a means to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got the means, that's when I went on the ship.
Yeah.
It was a terrible ship. There was terrible conditions. You know? They jammed them in like sardines in those immigration ships like the people came here.
Right,
know?
Sure.
And it was an old ship belonged to Sitmar Line, mm-hmm. called. And across the great bight of Australia, the South Australia, very rough seas,
mm-hmm.
and very high winds. And the shore of the ship was going backwards.
Mm.
It took us several weeks just to get across the great bight of Australia. And then up to the Suez Canal. And they were in some kind of a war at that time with Israel and France.
Right. That's right.
And there were Jews on board the ship. So the Egyptians wouldn't allow the ship to go through the canal.
Oh my goodness.
So I got off and went to Italy. I went to Egypt.
Right.
So I got to see the pyramids and whatnot. And so after these people left the ship, I came back and the ship and continued on to Genoa.
Mm-hmm.
And in Genoa, I was just on my way to England. You know, I had a letter of introduction. A big company called American Cyanamid Company.
Right.
They're now called SciTech.
Right.
I had a letter from the president in Australia to the president in England, a letter of introduction. Anyhow, I sat down in a bar in Genoa and ordered a beer. And the guy started talking to me in Italian. I said, I'm sorry, I don't speak Italian. In those days, I had the raw Australian accent, of course. He said, are you from Australia? I said, yeah. Oh, he said, I spent 2 years in Australia. I said, yeah. He said, yeah, I was a prisoner of war in a place called Wowan, 10 miles from Mount Morgan.
Hmm. How about that?
And they didn't consider the Italians as being bad people.
Right.
You know, because they'd been there for a long time.
Yeah.
So they worked on the farms there. And they were allowed to come into town at weekends and go to the bars. And you know, they had all the freedom except that they couldn't leave the place.
Right, right.
They were very good immigrants. They still were good immigrants.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, I got on to London. The guy said to me, I presented my letter. Oh, he said, we've been waiting for you. Where you been? I said, well, I stopped off in Italy a little bit. He said, we got a job for you in the Congo. Congo? I mean, all I remember about the Congo is that they eat people there. 3-year contract. I didn't like that idea too much. A uranium mine.
That's a commitment.
Yeah, that is a commitment. 3 years. I said, I find that a bit much. He said, well, what about the Gold Coast? It was the Gold Coast in those days, before it was Ghana.
Right.
I said, well, tell me. He said, they have short contracts. If you work underground, it's 1 year contract, followed by 3 months vacation. He said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I thought I'd still have take a little time to look around Europe. And he said, well, you go to the mill, that's what I went to, as the assistant superintendent. They have a 15-month contract, followed by 3 months vacation. So you want to go there, then you could come back, take your 3 months vacation in Europe at their expense. So that's what I did. I went to Ghana. It was quite an experience. One of the things that cover in the paper, knowing the culture.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say most of us are pretty ignorant about culture.
Right.
Even within our own country, you know, there's big, big differences from the north to southeast.
Right.
And Ghana was worse, that they spoke 13 languages, official languages, including English, and including giving the news by drums. It was a hot, stinking place. They had a long, wet part.
Wet season?
The wet. Mm-hmm. It rained continuous day and night.
Mm-hmm.
Then they went in a so-called dry season, where it only rained at night. Heavy, heavy rain. It was full of wild animals, leopards particularly.
Leopards?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And so you get all these insects banging on your window, no air conditioning again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rats would come after the insects, and the snakes would come after the rats, and then the final end of that chain is the leopard. And they had a cult which they called the Leopard Men. Very dangerous people. They dress up in leopard skins and go around killing people, you know? And the British was British colony, you know, at that time, and they arrested some of these people and hung them in the public square.
Hmm.
But they didn't convince anybody at that time. They were people, yeah, but other times they can turn into leopards.
Right.
So and you know, some very intelligent, well-educated people in Ghana still believe that. Yeah.
It's a powerful narrative.
Yeah. So it was... I liked the job. It was a good job. It was a gold mine.
And this is in Abaso. So is that in the Ashanti gold fields?
Yeah, further south from Ashanti.
Okay.
And the company was called Takwa and Abaso.
Yeah.
And that mine shut down. That's where I moved, but that's another question.
Okay.
They opened up another mine near there called Takwa by gold fields. Very rich mine. Still operating it after I left. But when I was there, there were three mines. The mill, because I worked in the mill, was on top of one of the mine shafts. The other two were further out. They brought the ore in by ropeway to this mill. At that time, it was only $35 gold, you know?
Right.
Underground mining, even though the labor was cheap, it was still very difficult to keep on the profit side.
Right.
So finally shut down.
Yeah,
I just couldn't make it at that price.
Yeah. And in 1953 to 55, this is just prior to the independence of... So Gold Coast becomes Ghana in 1957.
While I was there.
Just prior.
Kwame Nkrumah.
Yeah.
Kwame Nkrumah took over as... They had... what do you call it? Freedom, if that's the right word.
Independence. That's right. Yeah.
Partial independence.
Yeah.
Only in Ghana.
Right.
Not outside of Ghana, the Brits still controlled it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, we were a mixture of people there again. There were Welsh, Irish, Cornish miners, but there was a lot of South Africans because the mining ground, very similar to the mines in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But when that happened, you know, about the independence, they expelled all the South Africans because they got into this business of apartheid, you know, on that time.
Right.
And that made it a little difficult to work the mines. It was later on when I was working in New York, the bankers came to see me and they said, "Hey, we'll get these mines going again in Ghana." I said, "Well, you have to bring the South Africans back because they know how to mine that type of mine," which they did. They're back there now.
Right.
You know, they're doing very well there. Right. Newmont has two mines there. Hmm. Lots of other people are there. Mm-hmm. But it was a difficult country, and I got bad malaria.
I was going to ask you.
I got bad dysentery.
Yeah. How was your malaria treated? Do you remember?
How was what?
How was it treated?
With quinine.
Quinine?
Pelidrin was a tablet that we took, but Pelidrin. Okay. It didn't do any good.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Well, the mine I was on was on the lower edge of profit, just about gone broke.
Right.
And they used to have people come around, cut the grass around your house, you know, because the mosquitoes like to breed in the grass with all this rain.
Right.
And they had a central station where they boiled the water and delivered to your houses. I stayed in a house with the general foreman. And so they decided to stop cutting the grass. It was the worst mine in Ghana for malaria. And they decided that you get your servant to boil the water. Cut it out, because the servant didn't do it. Hmm. So because it's just stupid white men, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we all got bad dysentery. I had it for years and years. It wasn't until I got married that I got rid of it.
Huh.
And BB dysentery, you know?
Yeah.
Very bad.
Yeah, those things stick with you, especially malaria.
Yeah, when I left there, I got a bad malaria attack in London and I spent a week or so in the Hospital of Tropical Diseases in London.
Right.
And then I went on to New York and then to Peru. The day I arrived in Lima, I got another attack of malaria.
Hmm.
I went to the hospital in Lima.
Yeah.
And we had a system where you had vacation every 6 months to get down out of the altitude.
Yeah.
On that first 6 months vacation, I got an attack of malaria, and I never had it since. Gone. Hmm. And my wife cured them. She cured the dysentery by washing everything, boiled or raw, in Clorox to kill the bacteria that was upsetting.
Huh.
I'd have this dysentery, I'd go to the hospital, they give me some medicine, stop the dysentery. A week later, so I'm back again.
Yeah.
Every week.
Yeah.
But I think right now, I don't know how the dysentery is, but I know that it's still bad for malaria.
Oh, yeah. I think it's worse because of the dam, the Akasambo Dam.
And now there's some very bad strains, you know, of malaria.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I knew a guy, ambassador, to Uganda.
Yeah.
And his daughter came to visit him. In a week, she was dead.
Oh, my goodness.
Got this bad strain of malaria.
Yeah.
Killed her.
Yeah. Well, they're resistant now to the various forms of treatment.
That's right.
That makes it a lot more difficult.
Well, I tell you, quite frankly, Paul, I blame it on this banning of DDT.
Yeah?
Because DDT was sprayed around the houses everywhere to kill the malaria.
Yeah.
And it was just bad science, I tell you, really.
Yeah.
There was a big article about it in the Globe and Mail that I had one time in Toronto that banning DDT has been responsible for the death of millions of people in West Africa, well, all over here.
Yeah.
But they're back now to spraying the inside of the houses
and
the mosquito nets with DDT.
Yeah.
It wasn't a very pleasant time, I tell you.
Yeah.
And a lot of killing between tribes is a typical case of not knowing the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
of the mining company not knowing the culture of or in terms of
people
of the people
the people the tribal system
yeah
yeah they were very very divided. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they still are. But they certainly, one thing in those days, just thinking recently, we had both Muslims and Christians working in the plant. No problem.
Yeah.
No problem. We had to allow the Muslims time off to wash and pray. Mm-hmm. But there was no killing like that. What happened?
Yeah.
I don't know what happened because they lived peacefully and worked together there. Mm-hmm. In Ghana, the Muslims came from the north and the Christians from the south. And there was no problem between them.
Yeah.
What caused all this problem now, Paul?
Serious problem. Things outside of Africa, I think. There's a lot of stimulation of animosity from outside coming into West Africa.
Yeah, Nigeria. They did well into Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I don't know about Ghana. I haven't heard any problems in Ghana still.
Yeah. They seem to be going through a phase of prosperity now.
And the gold.
Yeah.
And of course, they grow a lot of cocoa too, you know, cocoa.
Yeah. And oil, and now they've found oil offshore.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't a great experience, but you got out of Australia, which was important for your career.
I left because the mine was losing money.
Yeah. Oh, out of Ghana, you left
out of Ghana.
Because it was...
Were you talking about Ghana?
I was just talking about the strategy of leaving Australia worked for you because...
It did work because, like this guy said, you have to leave Australia. Well, he came back as assistant superintendent. I came back as general manager. You know, if I hadn't left Australia, probably still be a ship boss.
Yeah.
Probably not now by now, but... That's the way it was.
And so you also mentioned that he said you weren't necessarily doing different things in Canada or the United States, but because you had left, you they regarded that you'd moved up somehow. In Ghana, you're a technical officer.
Yeah, which is like assistant superintendent.
Yeah.
I charge you all the technical things.
Yeah.
Metallurgical.
But this is a management position.
It's a management position.
Yeah.
And so
that helped you in the next step to the next phase of your career.
Yeah.
And so how did you find out about the opportunity in Peru?
A friend of mine.
Yeah.
And the mine was going going dead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, he also was an Australian. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, you might think about going to South America.
Yeah.
He said, I was in Bolivia for a couple of years, you know, mm-hmm. a contract there. But in Bolivia, in those days, this is in the 50s we're talking about, was a big mess too.
Yeah.
With the Bolivian strikers and the mines and terrible problems, you know. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, so I read in the magazine, they're looking for research metallurgists in Peru. Mm. Cerro de Pasco Corporation, which is an American company based in New York City and operating in Peru and Chile. Mm. So I applied for the job and I got it. Mm-hmm. And I had an interview with the director of the research department in London. He was also taking up his position at the same time, mm-hmm. new director. He was English nationality, but born in Germany. His name was Jacobi. He was Jewish, you know, mm-hmm. he had to get out of the country.
Right.
And he was a metallurgist like I was. And very soon I got promoted to senior metallurgist. And I spent several years there, and again, I wanted to get into operations.
Yeah.
So he said, well, I should go back to Mount Isa, how I got out of Mount Isa. In Mount Isa, the superintendent, the head of the lab, when I was working in the lab at ASAR, said, well, if you can find your replacement, we'll let you go into the plant. Mm-hmm. So of all people, the guy who lived next to me in Mount Morgan was interested. See, they were paying a bonus. They call a lead bonus. just based on the production of lead.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very good bonus. Mm. I don't remember now, something like 50% of your salary.
Okay.
And that's why a lot of people went there.
Right.
And I talked him into taking the job and allowed me to go out in the plant.
Can you talk for a little bit about the what's attractive to you about being in operations as opposed to being an, on the lab side or the
well, for one thing, Paul, money talks.
Right, okay.
And they always paid higher in operations than in the satellite places like laboratories or that kind of thing. And I liked it.
Yeah.
I preferred to be in operations. I liked to, you're producing something, you know? Mm-hmm. Something tangible.
Yeah.
Producing a concentrate or or metal.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I really went into the operations in both places.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine in operations you have to learn more about the total operations of the mine.
Oh, yes.
In order to understand your piece of it, you have to understand the flow of the processes.
Well, this Cerro de Pasco was a huge, huge, huge operation. You know, shut down right now.
Yeah.
It's about to be sold off. There are 11 bidders now bidding on it.
Yeah.
But, yes, and as I became, I was a middle-aged, the lead smelter and the copper smelter, I finished up there as the director of metallurgy.
Mm-hmm.
Which was over all the metallurgy from the plants, the smelters, the refineries, in charge of everything. I had 30 metallurgists working for me, which is another thing I found out from the American Management Association. You can't have 30 people reporting to you. You can't, just can't have that.
Yeah.
You should only have about 5 or 6 people reporting to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I promoted 6 of them.
Mm-hmm.
To senior metallurgists, and I only had 6 people reporting to me. But I got, American Management Association gave very good courses, and you could take them at the mine.
Hmm.
You didn't have to come to New York to do it.
Hmm.
I don't know how they are these days, whether they still give these courses or not.
Right. Well, it's perhaps you could describe coming to Peru. Coming to Peru and... your first arrival at Cerro de Pasco, because it's quite it's a giant operation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, going back to this culture thing, in Ghana, before we left, you had an interview with a psychologist, yeah? What do you think about colored people, working with colored people? I don't have any problem. But some of the English did. They arrived on site, and they're on the mix straight out. They just couldn't manage that culture shock, you know? Which I found quite strange, because we never had that in Australia, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and the same thing happened in Cerro de Pasco. Some people came there, they couldn't speak the language. They didn't like the conditions of high altitude. They take off right away.
Right.
So that's the guts of that paper, the importance of knowing culture. I gave that lecture, as a matter of fact, just in Peru last month in December. I was godfather, they call it in Peru, of 22 graduates in mining engineering from the University of San Marcos, which incidentally is the oldest university in the Americas, started by the Spaniards, of course, 500 years ago. And I gave that lecture to them about the importance of knowing the culture before you go. Looking back on it, I said to my wife, you know, if I had known all the things about Ghana beforehand, I probably went there.
Yeah.
Probably would never have went, because it was not a decent place to work in. Climate-wise, illnesses, war between the, you know, every Saturday night was bedlam, riding over to the next village to kill everybody, you know. I probably never would have went there if I'd known the culture beforehand.
Right, right.
And in Peru, too, it's very different from one part of the country to the other, Paul. People from the north, the south, the east, and the west. Very different cultures. Mm. And so it's not only a thing of knowing the culture for foreigners, and I put a lot of emphasis on the language, which is needed too. Mm. You need to learn the language, but the language is not enough. All these people in different parts of Peru, they all speak Spanish, but they have very different cultures, very different. I had 13 superintendents, different parts of the country, and they had to be treated differently, you know, because of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, that's... I liked it in Peru, because
mm-hmm.
I stayed there 16 years. You know, that's a long time.
That is a very long time. Yeah.
I really liked it. It was a good company, American company. We had all the good conditions of America. I had a contract. The first contract was 2 years and 9 months, mm-hmm. followed by a 3 month vacation. Then afterwards, you could do 2 year contracts if you wanted, with two months contract. Mm-hmm. You had a 15 days vacation every 6 months to come down out of the altitude.
Mm-hmm.
So to where adjust. I worked with was not one of the highest places in Peru, but it was 13,000 feet, and that's fairly high.
That is.
Some people couldn't stand it,
yeah,
you know, because of the altitude.
Yeah.
But later, when I went to Yanacocha, that was over 4,000 meters.
Yeah.
So
what are the effects of high altitude that people experience?
Your heart speeds up.
Yeah.
You have, your heart is circulating the blood through your body.
Yeah.
The air contains 1/3 less oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So to get the required oxygen into your lungs, you need to breathe harder.
Yeah.
And the heart beats harder.
Yeah.
Lots of people have heart attacks from
My goodness.
They yeah. call it mountain sickness. They get it here in Colorado too. Yeah. People get it here.
Yeah.
But absolutely the best treatment for it is to drink coca tea.
Hmm.
You know, which they make the cocaine
from. Yeah.
You just take the leaf
yeah.
and put it in hot water.
Huh.
Because the Indians know this for centuries.
Right.
And it calms your body down.
Right.
So the heart's not beating so hard.
Interesting.
But I've seen many, many occasions people go to visit. They just got the mine, they go down with an attack.
Yeah.
Because until we get them off, we have to just leave them with the nurses, you know,
right.
with oxygen.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It can kill you.
Yeah.
But luckily it never affected me.
Yeah.
Or Rosa either. But our little girl, it was born there.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we left the Sierra, went back, we had to put her in the hospital in an oxygen tent a couple of days.
Hmm.
She was badly affected by it, by the altitude.
Wow. So it's a large place. It seems vertically integrated. You've got facilities for actually producing wire.
Yes.
Pasco. Like
wire bars.
You're taking ore out of the ground and you're crushing it and you're processing it and
making different mines.
And you're making finished products out of it.
Yes, exactly. And it's all put into various smelters and refineries in La Roya, where I was based. But when I was director of metallurgy, I was also in charge of the metallurgy and the concentrators.
Mm-hmm.
I used to visit once a month. Every concentrator with the superintendent concentrator. But I liked the country, I liked the people, I very much liked the job,
mm-hmm.
and I learned to speak Spanish quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And in two years, I could speak pretty good Spanish. That's when I met Rosa.
Was that common for expats?
I gave classes.
Okay.
The company gave classes.
Yeah.
I took the first class, stage one, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was working with Peruvians, and picking it up on the job, you mm-hmm. know. There's not a lot of people speak English in Peru, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot.
Mm-hmm. And so it was part of the job was an expectation that you would.
Yeah.
But were there others in your level who did not really pick up Spanish?
Some people had a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Some people had a lot of trouble at grasping the language.
Yeah.
I have a friend, an American friend in Peru still today. He speaks broken Spanish, and mm-hmm. he's been there since, 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a wide range of aptitude.
Some people can't adapt to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
But you really have to if you're going to work there. Yeah.
Well, speaking of your ideas about culture, knowing the culture, that's kind of an essential piece of it is to learn a language to be able to communicate with people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
They put emphasis on learning the language.
Mm-hmm.
They did.
Yeah.
Another thing that Sarah DePasco did, Paul, was a very good thing. Every year we took 7 or 8 students, Peruvian students, and sent them here.
Yeah.
Colorado School of Mines, South Dakota School of Mines, Montana Tech, University of Arizona.
And the company did it itself?
Company did it.
Yeah.
The company did it. They don't do it anymore. And so a lot of those people became very big men mm-hmm. in the government and in the industry. In fact, the chairman of Newmont was one of these scholarship guys. Mm. My son was a Newmont scholar also.
Mm.
And the foreigners went into a 3-month crash course in English mm-hmm. before they went in the university to take their master's degree.
Mm.
And they stopped that now. I've been trying to revive it. And people are very keen on it, but can't get the companies interested in it, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of students in Peru
yeah.
that would like to come here to take their masters. But how are they going to be financed?
Was it a question of the time? It was the Cold War, and there was a concern about the United States being a good neighbor to South American countries. And
it switched from the time when I went to Cerro de Pasco, the staff, I know there was something like 20 million people, I think, 20,000
mm-hmm.
working for the company. All the staff were foreigners except one. Mm. When I left, there were about 10 foreigners left. So the idea was to Peruvianize,
yeah.
which makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah.
Makes a lot of sense there.
Yeah.
Because to bring foreigners to begin with is very expensive.
Yeah.
You know, they come on contract, they get conditions that are better than the Peruvians, which creates ill feelings too.
Yeah.
And so that's why I started Yanacocha with all Peruvians.
Yeah.
I was the only foreigner,
yeah.
the general manager.
That's an amazing transition right there.
When we were talking about going to Peru, Newmont said, well, how are we going to handle this? How are we going to handle the staffing, and how are we going to handle safety, security? Because
yeah.
terrorism was in force
yeah.
in 1992. When we started working on the project in 1980.
Yeah.
I left Peru in 1971. But I started going back again from New York, where I came to work for Cerro de Pasco in New York, to Peru every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But the president of the company was a guy called Peter Phillip. He was South African.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, you know, I can do this job, and I don't need any foreigners. He said, okay, go ahead. Try it. He came down to meet with the Minister of Mines a year later. And I knew the Minister of Mines. We'd worked together in Cerro de Pasco. And he couldn't speak English, so I had to take him in for it. And the idea of the meeting is, what are you going to do about terrorism? You know?
Mm-hmm.
The Minister of Mines actually had a good answer. He said, we're going to cut the head off of the snake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they did. They captured the top man in the Shining Path.
Right.
And it right. died.
Guzman.
The snake kept moving for a while, but it died.
Isn't that, yeah.
Coming out of his office, he said to me, you know, Lynn, when you said you could do this job, with all provings, there was a lot of resistance. We repeated it, there's a lot of resistance. You know what he said? Congratulations. I'm very proud of that ball, tell you the truth.
Yeah.
That I was able to put that mine into production during the time of terrorism with all provings. I'm very proud of that.
Well, let's take a break and we'll talk about that in great detail.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's an important story. So when you arrived at Cerro de Pasco, you were impressed by the size and complexity of this facility.
And I previously knew something about it. You know, I'd been made aware of it by going into their office in New York, you know, before I went there. And my arrival, the day I arrived, I got a malaria attack.
Right.
I went to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Came out of the hospital. It was in March now, 1955. And I went into the research department, the research ventilator. And we worked on a lot of different projects, different ore bodies. And like you say, all the way through this integrated thing from the mines through the mills, down into the smelters and the refineries, finished product. Mm-hmm. We produced high-grade metals there, very high-grade. Mm-hmm. The only problem we had was with copper. The copper was high in bismuth, and bismuth is poison for copper. It makes it brittle.
Right.
So when you draw it into wire, particularly very thin wire, it breaks all the time. And I got called up to New York while I was there. Metallurgist in New York said, you know, we make very good quality metals. You know, they're all the metals are there that we produce.
Right.
Except for copper. We need to do something about it. The only thing was that we could say about it is that we're selling the copper to China. Mm. And maybe it'd blow up in their face in the Korean War. But we never could solve that problem. Mm-hmm. Bismuth is just deadly for copper.
Yeah.
But it was a very successful company. Mm-hmm. It was the biggest taxpayer in Peru at that time. Mm. And so I went. And then it was nationalized. It went from one of the Minister of Mines made a talk one time. Mm. Cerro de Pasco went from the biggest payer of taxes in Peru to the biggest drain on the government nationalizing.
Well, this is something that's happening. So a lot of, I don't want to say a lot, but a number of significant South American economies were too dependent on the metals industry. So Chile, I think 70% of government revenue came from copper. From Anaconda and the other operators there.
Yeah.
And so that skewed. How does that affect the politics in those countries?
Very much to the left.
Yeah.
And for the first time in 1968, you know, Peru is famous or infamous for all of the military dictators they've had over the years. They were all rightist dictators until 68, this general Velasco Alvarado took over as a leftist. He denied being a communist, but they were following the Yugoslav line, that you could own some of your properties and you had more people employed than others, and you could keep it and otherwise. So it was a partial.
Mixed market, yeah.
Yeah, mixed. And they nationalized a lot of industry. And it was very turbulent times, lots of strikes. Mm. They were under the influence of, or trying to get under the influence of Cuba. Mm-hmm. Cuba was creating problems there, you know, even Che Guevara mm-hmm. went through Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And finally they made it just pretty well impossible for foreigners to live there. They made people bring all their bank accounts back to Peru.
So they, you couldn't hold foreign currencies?
Couldn't hold foreign currencies. And they made no doubts about it. They would open your letters quite brazenly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Find out you had a bank. You had to bring all your money back.
Hmm.
So it became increasingly more and more difficult, beginning, as I say, with the foreigners, but then later it spread into the Peruvians, too.
Mm-hmm. You know?
They had this junta. They figured they knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
There was a school that they'd go to, was called Escuela de Alto Militari, something like that. They learned a bit of law, a bit of engineering, a bit of medicine, and a bit of this accounting, lawyers, and that. So they figured they didn't need anybody. They could run it all.
Right, yeah. Right. It's like the Ecole Normale Supérieure.
Ran it
in
into
France.
The ground.
Right.
17,000% inflation.
By the end of the period, by the early 70s?
They changed the money into what they called Inti. Inti in English, in the English is the sun,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In Quechua. And there was one Inti, $1. Like a year later, it was 1 million Intis to $1. Unbelievable. People didn't have anything, you know. How could you live like that? To pay in the hotel, to pay your bill twice a day. Anyhow, I got a letter in the mail of some people that had worked there before, and they went to work in Marcona, you know, which is now Chinese-owned.
Mm-hmm.
And this fellow, he sent me a letter. He said, you know, we're looking for somebody with your capabilities to run an operation in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Rose, well, it started to look pretty difficult here. They wouldn't allow professionals to leave the country, proven professional. Couldn't leave the country. Couldn't take out very little money out of the country. And I said to Rose, this is only going to get worse, you know. Meanwhile, I got appointed as an advisor to the Minister of Mines. Took away my passport. And Rosa, being a nurse, which is professional, I thought the next thing they're going to stop her from leaving the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I arranged for her to go out of the country and stay with a friend in Miami. Because I said, you know, I'm a foreigner. They can't stop me from leaving the country.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner or later, I have to go.
Yeah.
So I saw her off at the airport, and at the airport, they handed me my passport.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very difficult times, and all this nationalization left and right. They were, you know, I say the Yugoslav type of communism, which is, I don't know too much about Yugoslavia, Paul, but there's a guy called Gilas who wrote several books. He was the right-hand man of...
Tito.
Yeah. And he was very much against the system. And he wrote several books. One was called The New Class. Hmm. The new class was the military.
Mm-hmm.
They got everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what Peru was.
Mm-hmm.
You go into a restaurant, it's full of military people.
Mm-hmm.
You go to sports events, they're all military people. A lot of emphasis on keeping the military. That's not going to work. So later, this thing is going to collapse.
Yeah.
We better get out of here. So I went. That's when I went back to Australia.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, I guess, a personal question? You mentioned that the law required people to hold their money in the currency, in the local currency. Did you lose a lot in that? In leaving the country, were you able to keep your money in?
The problem was the black market. It was on the black market. You got much more for your dollars than on the legal market, you know?
Right.
Because they started on the banks and left with one bank. Government bank was the only bank left. And when I was traveling now from New York to Peru, you had declared what money you're bringing into the country, and you have to declare what you're taking out, and where did you change it, yeah, to prevent this black market going on.
Yeah.
So I didn't have much, but I had invested in an apartment. I had an apartment in Lima, mm-hmm. which was a valuable piece of property, you know. Mm-hmm. But I could see that the writing was on the wall. It's not going to be for us.
Right.
So that's why I went back to Australia.
Yeah.
Quickly after getting the letter from this guy to be mine manager of the salt operation. Mm-hmm.
And we all know how things turned out, looking back. But at the time, what did things look like in terms of how things were going in Peru and in the world? How did it feel to you?
It did. It looked very bad in Peru, but in the home office in New York, they weren't exposed to this day-by-day thing. They didn't see why there was a great deal of problem, you know? But they went on to it every day. Mm-hmm. The world at that time, what was going on, was Korean War, no? Mm-hmm. 68 was the Korean War?
Vietnam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was going on. That
right.
was upsetting the world, as you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I went to Vietnam, you know. I went to Vietnam afterwards. Mm. But everything looked pretty grim, particularly in the mining industry.
Yeah.
It looked like we're going to go anywhere, you know.
Right.
Gold price was way down in those days. Mm-hmm. Silver. I mean, I looked at some papers the other day of a project that I was working on in Peru. 80 cents copper was it's silver. Mm-hmm. Silver was 80 cents. Mm. Copper was 70 cents now. And pretty hard to make money at those prices, you know?
The silver was 80 cents a pound or 80 cents an ounce?
Silver.
Silver, sorry. Yeah.
Silver was 80 cents an ounce.
Right. And copper,
and copper was 60, 70 cents an ounce.
Right.
It didn't look very good at all. The mining industry was in a big slump.
Yeah.
There in the end of the 60s, 70s.
Mm-hmm. So.
And then there's nationalization.
Right.
Going on. First in Chile. Mm-hmm. And then into Peru, you know. Made the situation worse.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, I guess, decreased global demand for things like copper.
Yeah.
There
right.
was a recession.
There was.
And so that.
Yeah, like I said, this copper. We left talking about that, this copper in the fish cages. And this is only relatively recently that the Chileans grabbed onto this. Mm-hmm. The fish cages, you know, where they're breeding particularly salmon.
Yeah, the farming fish farms.
They're made out of a nylon netting, which ultimately rots in the seawater and builds up a lot of barnacles on it. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen with this alloy that we made with the nickel industry. Mm-hmm. So they ran with it and then closed all of their fish farms, this expanded copper nickel alloy. Chile did it. That's very innovative. Mm-hmm. And of course, today they're the biggest exporter of salmon in the world.
So there was this creativity that followed. On
with the Chicago Boys.
Yeah. And then we were talking about that a bit off camera, that the tumult of the early 70s gave way to...
Was that Freeman was the professor? Was it?
Milton Friedman and Arnold
Milton
Harberger
Friedman.
And a number of them. But I think Arnold Harberger was, I think, in charge of the Chile project.
They looked around and what else can Chile produce, you know? Not so dependent on copper.
Right.
Price of copper was down, although I think those mines have always made money because mm-hmm. they're high grade deposits, you know. Easily treatable.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the Chilean copper mines produce an enormous proportion of the world's copper, don't they?
Yeah.
To this day.
Yeah. So. Oh, it's a third of the world's copper. One third.
It's hard to fathom. So there's this tumult, and then it gives way to opportunities for innovation. But for you personally, you just before we leave the early 70s, one important splashy thing that came out in 1972 was the Club of Rome report. And I remember that one of the it's this kind of it sounded an alarm about not about the ebb and flow of markets, but about the total supply of essential commodities and the versus the population of the earth and the human population of earth and the projected growth in the human population.
Yeah, we're going to run out of these.
Right. Yeah. And they've all the it's just curve after curve of just downward dwindling resources, and copper is among them.
Yeah.
Was that something that the industry talked about at all in terms of like total reserves? Is that something that...
You know, Cerro Pasco was still doing pretty good.
Yeah.
Because I left there in 71. Yeah. And they were, before they were nationalized, which was a long time ago, they were making $30 million a year, mm-hmm. which is a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
So they weren't too bad because they were diversified. And that's what the chairman of the company wanted to do, to diversify it.
Mm-hmm.
And with Cyril, finally went too far, diversified into things outside of mining,
right,
like trucking, film, and this kind of thing that nobody knew anything about because they were all brought up in the mining industry.
Right.
So they had to bring in another guy to handle these different things. His name was Murphy, advertised in the Wall Street Journal. And he became president of the company. And he started to take it very much in this direction, diversifying not only in country and not only in commodity, but also get out of the mining business altogether. Because, like you say, people were thinking very badly this mining business isn't going anywhere. And he thought they're preparing for the business by going out of mining completely. Well, not completely, but I mean, not completely dependent on mining.
Right, hedging it with other more
and
profitable
other,
areas.
Trucking company that took over, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up there. They were all a failure. They were all, because the Cerro de Pasco Corporation was formed back in 1901.
Mm-hmm.
They had a great school in mining and metallurgy. Didn't know anything about these other things. Finally, they got into a problem with the president being brought in to handle these things. They ousted the chairman in New York. The board ousted him.
Mm-hmm.
He was on vacation somewhere or other on the board.
Oh, this is Murphy who was ousted?
Yeah, throughout. Robert Koenig was the chairman for a long time,
mm-hmm.
from Alsace-Lorraine, you know, in France there.
Yeah.
And but he was the one that got the idea, too, of too much into mining, too much into South America. Now, we did have a refinery down in Missouri, a copper refinery there. They had fabricating plants over in Long Island and in Pennsylvania, making wire and tubing, you know, because that's still a big use for copper tubing. Yeah, they were very uncertain years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I thought, well, this is not going to get any better. I applied to have my diploma credited with the College of Engineers, which incidentally I'm now a member of.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't accredit it. They had no intention of accrediting foreigners diplomas and degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, it went on Cerro de Pasco, as you know, got nationalized.
Yeah.
They were not compensated at first, but later on they did get some compensation, mm-hmm. which was way below the value of the company.
Sure.
In that case. Yeah. As I say, in Chile it was fair compensation we got. So, I was in New York at the time, and Cerro de Pasco got nationalized.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed on there, but they said they wanted to keep somebody on the payroll, connection with metallurgy, and could speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. They were still interested in Latin America. But it went and collapsed. You know, the Prisker people took over the company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Prisker?
Priskers.
Okay.
You know, familiar with that family?
No.
Jewish family out of Chicago, very rich people, and they are experts that they're in taking over companies that are in bad shape with a lot of money in the kitty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they did here.
Mm-hmm.
They took over the company with money that was lying in the banks of Cerro de Pasco.
Okay.
And the whole thing collapsed.
Yeah. The Pritzkers, right.
Okay. Pritzkers took it over, yeah.
Okay. And so the writing was on the wall to get out of of Peru, and you got out of Peru and you were in
Well, in my case, being an Australian, and I haven't gotten a letter from this guy, they're looking for a general manager in Australia, salt operation, it just tipped it completely my way.
Right.
They wanted an Australian, if possible, mm-hmm. to be in charge. And so that's where I went to Solbite. And as you know, we did very well there. We produced 4 million tons of salt a year. It cost $2 a ton to produce, $2 a ton to ship Japan, and sold it for $6.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good little operation.
That is pretty good. Yeah. And you mentioned off camera, you ended up producing 4 million tons. But
yes.
What did you start with?
300,000.
300,000.
Yeah.
So you increased dramatically, you know, tenfold, more than tenfold.
Yeah, it was a great experience, Paul. When I went back to Australia, that was after 18 years that I'd left.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the country very much changed,
mm-hmm.
very negative.
Yeah.
And the unions took over the country, you know, in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And all the government was, you know, union organizers or union representatives. The prime minister himself had been nothing else but a union rabble-rouser, if you like. You know? what was my point I was going to talk about?
Well, that you'd come back and it had changed. It had
changed to the negative.
There was a lot more.
Every time I opened my mouth, we tried that. Didn't work. Now, that won't work. Our people will never accept that, you know, or this kind of thing. So I called all the superintendents in my office one day and I said, look, what happened to the saying in Australia, let's give it a bash?
Yeah.
That's what they used to say. So we had an incident that happened. We had 13 trucks on the road there. And they were all driving with Yokohama tire.
Mm-hmm.
Came about that we couldn't get these tires. Something had happened at a factory, I don't remember. And we had a contractor on site, a company called Brambles, big people in the trucking business in Australia. And they had a foreman there. We had a small contract going on, earth moving.
Yeah.
And he said, I understand you're having trouble getting tires. I said, yeah. He said, well, have you ever thought about Michelin tires? I said, look, tell you the truth, I didn't want tire from another. He said, well, we have 40,000 trucks on the road in Australia. And they all use Michelin tires. Why? Because we're the Michelin tire representatives. So, all right, so I said to my assistant, I said, you know, I just talked to this guy, Ryan was his name. He said, if you put those tires on our trucks, you got a strike on your hands tomorrow. Hmm. What are you talking about? He said, our drivers won't drive with a piece of tire. So anyhow, I went back to the foreman and I said, you know, this is the answer I got about the tire. He said, well, we work 2 12-hour shifts. He said, if you bring in the later shifts and let the other ones off an hour earlier, we can bring up the experts from Perth, which they did. This guy incidentally went on vacation. He had to go later on, you know? Mm-hmm. And anyhow, they got up and I called all the drivers to come into the meeting, explain what they do, Michelin, this guy, that. After it was all over, I got up and I said to the drivers, well, what do you think? And the union rep said, let's give it a bash. That's the Australia I knew. No?
Yeah, yeah.
We put Michelin tires on those trucks, and they're still driving with Michelin tires.
So it just required some conversations.
Yeah, I turned, that was the main thing I did, Paul. I turned around their thinking to be positive, not negative.
Right.
And every time I opened my mouth, that won't work out, people. You're going to strike on your hands, all this stuff.
Yeah.
By taking the positive attitude, that's why we went up.
Yeah.
You know? And that theory of mind, you know, planning, organization, and control, delegation, that worked well.
Yeah. Now, you said the original saying from the American Management Association was planning, organization, and something.
Yeah, it was called planning, organization, and control. Mm-hmm. And I added delegation to it. Mm-hmm. But you have to have a plan, mm-hmm. and you have to have an organization to carry out that plan. And there's no sense in telling a truck driver, we're producing 4 million tons of salt a year. What does that mean to him? It doesn't mean anything.
Right.
So many trips from the mine to the port you have to make on your ship.
Yeah.
And that will fall right into the plan.
Yeah.
That's all he needs to know.
Yeah.
If you do that, we'll get up in the production.
Right, right.
And it worked, Paul. It worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I turned it around completely.
Yeah.
When I left, one of the people said to me, you know, you did a good job here. You turned this company around. There's one thing you can't do, though, is control the weather. I said, yes, I can. Mm-hmm. He said, how would you do that? You know, in Australia, they give people long vacations, like a month a year. When it was raining, I shut it down, send everybody on vacation. I had another problem there that, you know, in Australia, they have bars at the mines, which I don't think is a good idea.
Probably not, yeah.
But anyhow, we worked 6 days a week. And all of the superintendents would turn up on Sunday at the mine. And the women complained to me about their husbands having to go to work 7 days a week. Said, what's going on here? We had a bar on the mine, and the bars didn't open in the town. Simple as that. They're going to drink beer at the mine because they couldn't get a drink in Carnarvon. So I cut that out. I said, no, we only... one superintendent every Sunday. That's all we need.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I can tell you this rain, which rained 4 inches a year, but it rained all in 2 days. Very flat country. Mm-hmm. So the whole countryside was flooded.
Yeah.
And it took a long time for that water to go down. At the mine itself, after the storm was over, within a few days, you could put it back into production. I stayed on site. I found out I was the only guy staying there.
You were the
staying
only
there.
Yeah, you were the only
Because everybody took off to town,
right.
Worried about the hurricane and their families.
Right.
No, that's not going to work. It's not going to work. Some of you guys have to stay with me at the mine. Others will go into town, look after the families, make sure they don't have problems with the hurricane, and we can get started up at the mine before you can get to the mine.
Yeah.
Because the roads were flooded.
Right, right.
So there were two big problems which I overcame.
Right, yeah. Right. And it sounds like you were... off camera, you showed me these beautiful photographs of the operation that you had there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And
desert country, you know.
And you engineered this incredible throughput of the salt evaporation ponds, and then using a kind of modified snow plow to harvest. Essentially, you literally have a harvester.
We call them harvesters.
Yeah, you're harvesting salt.
Yeah,
and then you're essentially plowing it down a hill into these conveyors that take it to port. And it's this, you can see why it increased the production tenfold.
Yeah.
With this kind of setup. So this is kind of a return for you, because if I'm not mistaken, you had managerial responsibility in Ghana, and
yes,
you were in charge of metallurgy overall at Cerro de Pasco, but Cerro de Pasco is huge.
Later.
And so when you came to Texada Mines in Cape Cuvier in Western Australia, you're the director of all.
Yeah, I was the top man in the company at mine site.
Yeah.
So that was... From my point of view, it was very good, because I could then put into practice what I saw as the way to do it.
Right.
And it worked.
Right.
It worked.
Right. Did you apply lessons learned from that experience to other things that you did subsequently?
There's one of those papers there, Paul, which is partly concerning that. It's plant design, what not to do.
Yeah.
And that's based on my 60-odd years of practice in operations, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
That people keep committing the same mistakes over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly with engineering firms. And they have to break that, get away with it. Now, this was a symposium. It was held in Phoenix. They asked me to write a paper, and I thought, well, this is the time to put a lot of this down on paper, at what not to do.
Right.
Yeah? It was very well received, mm-hmm. very well received.
What are a couple of examples of things not to do? I don't want to get too technical, but general principles that are shortcomings.
One of the main things was repeating mistakes by the engineering firms. They would build into the drawings certain equipment that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
The next time you come around, they got the same mistake in there again. We tried to overcome this at Newmont. We set up a 3-man committee, all people about my age with lots of experience. So whenever we're working on a new project or expanded project, it came to us first to look for these pitfalls, you call them.
Yeah.
And eliminate for the next time around.
Right, right.
Well, let me see. Let me refresh my memory there a little bit. Have a look at that paper.
Well, we can...
On there...
Okay.
It has been the author's experience since he began his career as an indentured cadet metallurgist at Mount Morgan Limited in Australia in 1943 that many mistakes have been made in the past when designing mineral processing plants. Unfortunately, many of these same mistakes continue today by engineering firms, in some cases by the operators themselves. A list of items that should not be done prior to and at the design stage, presented and discussed in some detail, consideration for those concerned at the side of the business. Yeah? Now, don't skimp on the test work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Don't skimp on the test work. Okay, yeah. That's a good principle.
That's the first one.
Yeah. A kind of adjusted version of measure twice, cut once.
Don't forget your Economics 101 class. The idea is to make money. It's economics.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't leave certain important people off the design team. Mm-hmm. Their tendency to leave mechanical people off of the design team. We started at Newmont, we put always a mechanical person on, because somebody's got to do the maintenance in these plants. Mm-hmm. They should be in it right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. When purchasing used equipment, don't send a boy to do a man's job.
What does that mean?
Well, we had these cases that somebody would go out and have a look at the equipment who really wasn't qualified to look at the equipment. Mm-hmm. Would approve it. We had a case like that in Mexico. Mm. Bought some used plant equipment, much cheaper than you could put in new. Mm-hmm. But we ended up having to put another $1 million into it to bring it up to shape.
Right.
If you sent a good mechanical engineer to have a look at it in the first place, they probably never bought it. Mm-hmm. Don't jam the equipment into the smallest possible space. Mm-hmm. Don't install faulty electrical switchgear or located in the tight corners of potential wet areas.
This sounds really basic, and yet this is something that's happened
basic.
Over
You're
and over and over.
Absolutely right, it's basic.
Yeah.
Don't place the equipment on faulty foundations or on weak ground.
Oh my God.
There's been many cases of that, Paul.
Oh.
A big crusher I know they've installed in Peru. The whole thing collapsed before they even put the plant in operation.
Right, yeah.
Don't install unworkable chutes below ore stockpiles and fine ore bins. Mm-hmm. You never get it out of the bins.
Right.
Don't be stingy on installing duplicate vital equipment. Mm-hmm. Don't install defective equipment. Don't hesitate to use the natural contours of the land. You know, in the early days, all the mills were built on the slope of a hill. Mm-hmm. So you could gravitate the pulp down.
Right.
Now you have to pump it.
Right.
And in Ghana, I saw they put pumps down in a well.
Yeah.
The wells get flooded and knocks out all the motors.
Right, right.
Don't fail to install adequate safety guards on machinery and motors and prepare safety manuals along with the plant design. Mm. Don't wait to the last minute to prepare operator training manuals. Mm. Don't hesitate to design the plant to be a pleasant place to work in.
That's not a small matter, right?
Yeah.
In terms of... Yeah.
Like you say, these are all basic things.
Yeah. Yeah, but the very fact that you felt compelled to write this list speaks to the fact that these lessons haven't been learned in a lot of cases.
Don't over-automate the operations of the plant. Mm-hmm. A lot of people completely automate the plants and the operator can't get in. Mm. The opposite to that is the plant we had in Canada and British Columbia, where we had a continuous online analyzer. Mm-hmm. They hook these up to controls. Mm-hmm. As it goes out, you know, nobody knows how to get in there or change it. We just had this thing to show what the assay results were, mm-hmm. and gave the operator an instrument to help him with his job.
Right, but not as a complete replacement.
Yeah.
Right.
Don't neglect the environment.
That's a big one, yeah. So there are all these rules that that you've gleaned from your experience.
Yeah.
And
one of the basic things, don't build the mill before you have a mine. I've seen that done. That's, of course, that's obvious, isn't it?
It is.
People do it.
How would that work? How would you build a mill before you had a mine? How could you?
We built one in Kentucky.
Oh.
In Paducah, Kentucky. It's not the only one. Mm-hmm. There's one I was associated with. They put all the emphasis on the plant. Mm-hmm. Put a lot of money into the plant on the plant. They couldn't get the ore out of the mine because it was like raining underground all the time. It was saturated with water. The plant is lying out in the cornfields down there in Paducah.
It's still there.
Still there. Yes. Bits and pieces of it.
Right, right.
That's the basic. You think it's the basics, don't you?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Why should you have to remind people about this? Yeah?
But it's
don't design and build the mill until you have a mine. Now this, I said, you know, this is number one in the don'ts. Sounds very obvious, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But, sounds very obvious, doesn't it? But the author is aware of several cases where it occurred and several other cases that were near misses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's you know, they like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you said it yourself. These things are obvious.
Yeah. But or should be. And that's the lesson, I guess, is that don't, you know, discount that these things might be. There we go.
Yeah. And then another one is that buying equipment, they don't always inspect it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
We had installed an electric generator in Mexico. It blew up in 2 weeks. A brand new, how could that happen?
Yeah, yeah.
How could that happen?
Yeah.
And we had rotary kilns,
which
have a ring on the outside where the ring came off. You had to pull the whole thing down and re-weld it. We had two of them, so we dropped the production by 50%.
So this is not a small, so something, a mistake like that can cost how much?
A lot of money.
Millions of dollars.
Well, yeah, good, yeah. Well, I don't know. Look, it probably took more than a month to get that rotary furnace back into operation.
Right.
We were producing what, I don't know, something like, say, 10,000 ounces of gold a month in this particular property. Go to half production, it's 5,000 ounces of gold.
Right.
At $1,000 an ounce, a lot of money.
That's right. That's right. So you have learned lessons from managing, and you've passed those on in these kinds of educational articles, and you've lectured, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. I want to pass now to asking you about the transition to Newmont, which is another long period in your career. Can you talk about how you ended up moving to Newmont after Texada Mines?
I was working in New York for Cerro Pasco Corporation when this nationalization took place.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Newmont, it was in the same building in New York, in Park Avenue, and I knew some of the people there, again, who'd come from Cerro Pasco.
Mm-hmm.
They said, what about a job? I said, okay, so I interviewed with the chairman, who had played a Mello Seymour, and the president, who was Thompson, I forgot his first name.
Mm.
He said, okay, yeah, come work for us. And so I got transferred to Danbury, where Newmont had their research and development. The geophysicists were also located there, where they have very fragile instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to take it outside of New York City because the interference.
Right.
Except in Danbury.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in Danbury, I don't know, for a few years. The first place I went to was South Africa and Namibia in particular. did a lot of work there with them. Later became a director of those companies. And then I was the vice president of research and development, was retiring. So they made me first assistant vice president to him. Then when he retired, I took over his job, the vice president of research and development. We moved then from New York to Denver. And in the move, some people didn't want to move from New York. And we felt they were important people, that they should come. So I gave up my position as vice president of research and development and became vice president of metallurgical operations. And I worked all over the world, looking for projects in Eastern Europe and Spain, and was it back in South America. Okay, because when I was still, after I left Yanacocha, I became president and general manager of Newmont Peru, and vice president and general manager of Newmont Latin America. So then when I was, the way that Newmont worked, it was a holding company. They had bits and pieces of different companies. Some of them later on, they took over 100%, like Magma Copper Company, and these companies in South Africa, Elkeep Copper Company, Sumeb. They never changed it. Palabora was a percentage, it was 20 or 30%. So they had in New York City so-called experts in the various fields. Like lawyers. Accountants, engineers, metallurgical people like myself, and also the metallurgical operations, mine operations. And the task was to go around to these places and look for ways of doing things better and cheaper.
So you were involved in assessing the efficiency of overall operations of these of these subsidiaries.
And new projects.
And new projects.
Existing projects, how we could increase the recoveries, and the new projects that were being built. So that was my responsibilities. And as a result of that time, we opened up the mine in Uzbekistan. A joint venture with the Uzbek government.
This was after the collapse. After the collapse of the former Soviet Union? Was this after the collapse of the USSR?
It started off before. Started off before. There was a geologist, a friend of mine, very interesting guy. His name is Joko Wallach. And he was born in a German slave labor camp. His father was a coal miner, and the Germans took him first to Germany and then to Belgium to work in the coal mines. And he speaks all of these Slav languages, Yugoslav, Polish. His father was Pole, Russian. And he went to a meeting in Moscow, and everything must be in 91. And they, while he was there, some of the people from Saroshan invited him to come visit. He was the first foreigner in there in 70 years.
In which city?
Uzbekistan.
In Uzbekistan, okay.
In 70 years, he was the first foreigner. And he saw there that they were milling, they had huge mills over a mile long. 2,000 people worked only in the mill. And, of course, it was communist, you know, and there were a lot of this. The whole plant was staffed by a gulag. And so I went with him then on the next trip, and they had stockpiled a lot of relatively low-grade material. They were milling through their mills 3 grams per ton. and they were taking stuff out at 1.5 grams per ton, which today is all. Mm-hmm. And we saw it as all. See, the idea of heap leaching had not reached the USSR yet. Mm-hmm. So we made a deal with them. 1/3 Newmont, 1/3 the Uzbek government, and 1/3 the Geological Society. They had an enormous amount of geologists. The Russians and those other states, very good geologists, mm-hmm. very good. Of course, they don't know anything about making money. That's something else. Like I say, don't forget your economics.
Right, right, right.
And so we set up this deal there, which started off very well, you know? And the Uzbek government was selling their gold to Central, to Moscow, mm-hmm. $40 an ounce. Mm-hmm. And when in the open market, that time, must have been about $400 an ounce. So they asked Newmont, they wanted to break away from Russia. They didn't like the Russians at all. And if Newmont would take over the marketing of their gold as well, from the existing plant, they're producing over 1 million ounces of gold.
Wow.
A year.
That's, yeah.
This place did not appear on the map. Didn't exist.
Officially.
Officially.
It didn't exist.
It was in the middle of where they produce all the uranium.
Right.
The uranium area.
Right. So there are towns, whole towns that don't actually exist.
Yeah, it was very close. I was driving through there, and this guy said, you want to take some pictures? No, I'm not taking any pictures here. This was just before they even broke away.
And then right.
The next thing, 1992, I was in Russia, Siberia. Mm. When the whole thing fell apart in Russia, you know,
yeah.
Yeltsin and everything.
Right, sure.
I was there that same weekend.
Yeah.
And they had in Moscow, guy said, you see that building over there? I said, yeah. He said, that's the tallest building in Moscow. I said, what do you mean? It looks like 4 or 5 stories. He said, yeah, but underground, there's 20 or 30 stories. We took off. That Sunday from Moscow, there was a huge statue of the guy who started the KGB. I don't remember his name anyhow, one of those long Russian names.
Yeah.
We got lost. We got lost in Uzbekistan. We didn't know where we were. My wife was frantic, couldn't make contact. Mm-hmm. We were lost in this place called Sarashan. Nobody knew where it was, didn't exist. Couldn't get us out of there. The nearest place to get out was Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And the road coming into Sarashan would suddenly wide way up out and they'd close gates.
Yeah.
Both ends, about 5 miles long,
yeah.
A mile wide, bombing Afghanistan from near the mine. That's in U.S. control now, that airstrip.
Okay.
The nearest place was Afghanistan.
Wow.
Anyhow, finally we did get out. When I came back to the States, the CIA contacted me. What did you see there? They didn't know what was going on. They thought it had something to do with uranium.
Yeah.
It was just this enormous gold plant.
Yeah.
Huge open pit. Didn't exist anywhere.
Interesting.
But that fell apart too, you probably know, Paul. They nationalized that later on.
Mm-hmm.
They raised the taxes. The contract was written at 30% tax. They wanted to raise that.
The Uzbek government.
The Uzbek government.
Yeah.
So it was nationalized, though. You might have lost that, too.
Right.
But we had some very interesting times. And I had, like all of us in New York, we had very interesting jobs going around to Newmont's different operations and potential operations. Mm-hmm. Looking at them was a very, very, very interesting job.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just, I imagine at the level of operations, if you're the director, so you've been VP of Metallurgical Operations, VP of R&D, Director of Newmont Exploration Limited, which was worldwide. and you had advised or directed the subsidiaries in Canada, Australia, South Africa.
Yermont Mines in Canada.
Yeah,
this is,
yeah, and Namibia.
Yermont, Australia. Yeah. A short period before they sold that operation.
So talk to me a little bit about the interface between the technical and the political and the social. So,
well, technically, it was very interesting, a technical point of view, particularly, that things they were doing at one plant, they were not doing at another plant. And why? Oh, they're working here. They were working here. The same old attitude, negative attitude. Mm-hmm. So I started by bringing together all of the plant superintendents all over the world. Mm-hmm. We had the first meeting in Tucson, Arizona, and let people, instead of talking to me about this equipment that they have in southern Peru, for example, mm-hmm. the southern Peru superintendent can talk directly to his superintendent.
Right.
And there were several things. One was called particle science, particle size monitor, which is an instrument which records always the size.
Right, when you're crushing.
Yeah, and control the feed to the plant.
Right.
That's what they do in southern Peru.
Right.
And I tried to talk to them in Palabora to do that. No, that won't work. So anyhow, I brought this guy who was selling this equipment there and let him talk to the superintendent. And I said to him, why don't you give them one to put on trial? He said, yeah, that's a good idea. And he did. And there were other cases that, principally it was a case of negativism mm-hmm. from one plant to the other. Mm-hmm. The size of the equipment, the type of equipment, mm-hmm. whether it should be Denver, for example, or it should be Outokumpu, or it should be somebody else's equipment. We love it in this place. That don't work here. Mm. And then we had another one I called the Mill Managers Conference in Elko, Nevada. Was a very, very good system. Yeah?
Yeah.
Now, politically, well, we were in Peru, in southern Peru Copper Corporation. We owned 11% that operated. In South Africa, in the time of apartheid.
Yeah.
And Namibia and Australia.
Yeah.
And South Africa. And politically, Newmont was always on the front edge of this. Mm-hmm. The Afrikaners, you know, that's the Dutch, people of Africa, South Africa. There are two types. One in Africa, as they call verkrampt or verlichte. Verkrampt means against everything. I see. Yeah? Against any change.
Right.
Verlichte is the enlightened ones.
Right.
And all the plants we were involved in South Africa, in Libya, there were these enlightened people.
Yeah.
And they brought about a lot of changes. Mm-hmm. In apartheid, broke the law in some cases. Mm-hmm. The manager of one of the mines at O'Keeffe, they were going to build houses where previously the blacks had lived. Mm-hmm. It's against the law. They didn't care, they went ahead. Mm-hmm. Built a house, and the manager went and lived in that house.
To make the point.
The another point was crane drivers. Were you all right? Mm-hmm. They had to be white. Mm-hmm. He put in natives, yeah. What they called Cape Coloreds, mm-hmm. you know? Half-breeds to drive it. Of course, the nationwide strike, putting these colors in, that was reserved for whites.
When was that? What year was that?
This was in the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
Because we got out of there about 89, something like that.
Yeah.
At Palabora was a very interesting case. The company had their own hospital. And they put in the chief of the hospital, the black man. Caused a big uproar, you know? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, that's it. I mean, if you don't want to go to our hospital, you can go and get your treatment somewhere else.
Yeah.
It just broke the laws in
right.
the case.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
They were very much advanced.
Yeah.
Because they could see that apartheid was going to, sooner or later, was going to collapse.
Right.
Which it did.
Right. Yeah? So I'm hearing that, you know, there's the, you're always looking for the guys, the folks who will say, give it a bash. The people who are willing to take a chance on something new.
We always did.
Yeah.
We always looked for people, enlightened ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That were positive thinking, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And my daughter went to Notre Dame University. Mm-hmm. And when I took her there, the dean of studies said, you know, it's always been considered in life there are two inevitables, death and taxes. I think that comes from one of the founders of the UN. And she said, was a nun. He said, there is another inevitable, not necessarily for the good, nevertheless inevitable. That is called change. Mm-hmm. So I went to Namibia, and they had a middle tier staff people, like superintendents, and there was an Englishman giving them a talk about change. And the general manager put me on the spot. He said, no, we have Mr. Harris here, the director of the company from New York. Would you like to say something? So I told him that story mm-hmm. about Notre Dame. And one guy got up and he said, yeah, changes, everything for the black man, nothing for us, the whites. Mm-hmm. It's inevitable. So he used that year what I told him, what I'd learned at Notre Dame, as his Christmas message to his staff. Yeah, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
Which it turned out to be.
Yeah. And another piece of the story that you're telling is that you know, part of the resistance is not just negativity, but it's this perception in each locality that the locality is unique, right? That they've got unique problems and unique networks and unique resources. And so you can't have a cookie cutter solution from on top. You can't say, oh, we're doing this at Newmont worldwide, we're going to impose this. So there's this resistance to change from outside. There's some truth to that. Like, I think every mind is different, and there are unique challenges. But you were looking for ways to cross-pollinate, maybe. There's something that really works over here. Maybe that could work in this other place.
Yeah, and it did.
And it did when you implemented
it. Yeah, it did.
It. Yeah.
And then on the political side, it was tough going for these managers in South Africa and Namibia. They're going against the stream. They're breaking the law, even, you know?
Yeah.
But it had to come. Now, the thing, of course, Paul, you don't want change just for change's sake.
Right.
Some people have fallen into that, including Coca-Cola, you might remember.
Right.
They changed it from classic and didn't sell worth a damn, but they felt that they had to change something.
Right.
So, yes, it's good. Some cases not so good. In this case, the changes that were coming in Africa weren't all that good for the white man.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the way it was. They were in the minority, you know. So they had to come.
Mm-hmm.
But Newmont was in the forefront that way.
Yeah.
They were also in the forefront of pushing new projects to the communities, to the people around the mines, which was not in force in Peru
mm-hmm.
when I went there.
Mm-hmm.
And Newmont was pushing me, we have to take the project to the people, because that's what they were doing here and elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The Minister of Mines said, you will not do that.
In Peru?
We will take it to the community.
Right.
The Minister of Mines will take it to the community.
Right.
They had to change.
Yeah.
Now they have to take, in Peru particularly now, is a big problem with the communities.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take your project and get approval.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's Aboriginal resistance in the Amazon to Peruvian.
There is, right
to
today.
They
got a
mining.
Big strike going on in the jungle right now as we speak against the oil companies.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we can't deny, like that article I wrote there about, the mining, importance of mining. We can't deny that we did bad things in the past.
No.
We can't deny that. That we shouldn't repeat them.
Right.
I shouldn't repeat them.
Yeah.
And I push that out. All these young engineers, you have to look after the environment. Mm. It's part of doing the job.
Yeah.
If it's going to cost so much, and I've never seen it yet, if it will break the company, then you don't have a project.
Right.
You have to do it. Mm. You have to take... We have to... the old thinking... And I guess I was in that category too, Paul, younger. Mm-hmm. We come in, we give work, open up the mine, pay taxes, and that's it.
Right.
It's not good enough anymore. Mm-hmm. You have to do something with your surrounding communities. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some very ugly killings because of that. Mm-hmm. And they won't cooperate with the community, or the community won't cooperate with the mine. Mm-hmm. We have to change. We still have to change yet. Mm-hmm. And I honestly believe that the part that's best, not everybody agrees with me, by no means, is to give the communities part of the operation, make them partners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Give them a percentage
give
of
them
the...
Give them percentage ownership.
Of the ownership, yeah.
This plant I'm talking about, this place in Peru, when they gave them 5%, the problems they had with that community were unbearable.
Yeah.
When they did that, it disappeared.
Yeah.
Disappeared completely, the problems of the community.
Hmm.
5%.
Yeah.
Now, I push that down to companies I'm a director of, but they're starting to get it, too.
Mm-hmm.
But the old time is, we should give them anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, we supply work and pay the taxes, no?
Mm-hmm.
And I was interviewed in Bolivia. I gave a talk on Yanacocha, and the newspaper men came. Said, Mr. Harris, we here in Bolivia are used to, not only foreigners, but Bolivians too, coming in and opening mines and work at the shore. They give work, pay their taxes, and they leave us with tailings.
Yeah.
Then it can't work. Mm-hmm. That can't work anymore.
Yeah.
Can't work anymore.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Well, let's talk then a little bit about Yanacocha, because that's an important story for you personally, and for your wife Rosa, who was involved in that. So, this is while you're at Newmont, and there's a whole context that needs to be set up here. This is 1992 that you start, but it begins before that. Can you set up the context for Yanacocha?
Yes, we started off. With the French owned the property. Mm. French Bureau of Mines, they owned it.
Mm.
They had no money. They had to develop it. They had an exploration camp at on site. The Japanese had been there. Cerro de Pasco had been there. The British had been there looking for silver. And there was a guy called Aubrey Pavitt. He was a geologist, born in South Africa, but Australian nationality. The company decided that they wanted to have a greater presence in South America.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't speak any Spanish, so he went with me. First of all, we went to Chile. But Chile was just getting over the Allende campaign, and hundreds of people were flocking into Chile in the mining business.
Mm-hmm.
So we came too late. Mm-hmm. So we went to Peru, and I took him up. We looked at this Yanacocha, and his eyes literally shone like diamonds. He said, this is a gold property. This is a disseminated gold property. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah? All right, so we started, and fair enough, that's what it was. And the company then, Yanacocha, was formed in July of 1992. It was Newmont with 40%. No, Newmont with 20%. The French with 40%. And Buenaventura with 20%. Mm-hmm. And later on came the IFC with 5%. They're still there. All the companies around those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to drill it. And I was looking at the metallurgy of it. And we're doing work in the lab in columns, leaching it.
Mm-hmm.
Leaching it half an inch, 1 inch, 2 inches, 3 inches, 4 inches. The same extraction.
Mm-hmm.
The same extraction. Didn't need to grind it. Didn't need to crush it. That was the beauty of it all. The French couldn't believe it. I said, all right, you take some of it to France. They found out the same thing,
mm-hmm.
that you could run a mine leach, take it straight out of the mine, load it onto trucks, and dump it, and begin leaching.
Yeah.
It worked. It worked the same at half inch as it did at 1 foot,
yeah.
or 1 meter even.
Right.
It's an exceptional deposit, exceptional deposit.
For
heap leaching. Been worked before by the Spaniards.
Yeah.
They took all the coarse gold out of it.
Right.
Now this was fine gold. This is, well, it was 1.3 grams. And I said, Alberto Benavides said to me, yeah, he was on the Buenaventura side, of course, you know him? Never
no.
heard of him?
No.
Well, he was chairman of Buenaventura,
mm-hmm.
which became the other partner.
Right.
Today, well, how's it go today? Newmont is 50%. Buenaventura has 45, and the French and the IFC has 5.
Mm-hmm. And the French are out completely.
The French were out.
Yeah.
It's another story, of course. Mm. But anyhow, he said 1.3 grams. We're throwing away higher grade than that from our mills. Because this business of heap leaching had not reached Peru yet.
Yeah.
It was developed out here in Nevada by the U.S. Bureau of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very useful in Nevada because the ore contained a lot of clay.
Mm-hmm.
It was impossible to get it through the crushers, particularly in the thaw time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this allowed you to add a little cement, put it in a drum, and heap leach it.
Mm-hmm.
And that started the whole business.
Yeah. And just for our readers and listeners, that heap leaching is you take ore and you bring it out onto some kind of bed.
Yes.
And you
normally it's crushed.
It's crushed.
Not,
okay.
But not Newmont, not the Yanacocha.
Because of the clay or something.
Because of the way the mineral. You could take a piece of it and pour water on it. It would go straight through just like a sponge.
Oh, it's kind of porous.
Very porous.
Okay.
Very, very porous.
Great. So it's
very
ideal.
Low cyanide consumption.
Mm-hmm.
30 grams per ton.
Mm-hmm.
Very low lime consumption, 200 grams per ton.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are still skeptic about the treatment processing method.
Yeah.
So we put up a pilot plant first,
mm-hmm.
10,000 tons. Boom, the curve went up. In 4 days, the extraction was 80%. Unheard of.
Mm.
And I don't think there's any other deposit in the world is just perfect for heap leaching.
And this region had already been mined
by the Spaniards
ages ago. Right.
They took all the coarse gold out.
Right. So you were left with these fine particles that are
very fine particles
embedded,
so-called invisible gold.
Right.
Which is the same as the mines in Nevada. Yeah.
Right.
And well, when we first went there, I saw some ugly things happen in the communities.
Yeah.
The communities wouldn't let us on their property.
Yeah.
But they have a lot of respect for nurses. Mm-hmm. We had this nurse, a local girl. I hired her. And she could go into the villages and talk to the people. I told her, don't stay overnight. Just go in and talk to them and come out with bodyguards. Which she did, and we opened up working position with the communities. Mm-hmm. By the time we finished, we had a good thing going, which has gone to hell since.
When you said there were killings, who was killed and who was doing
the killing? When I was there in the Cerro de Pasco days, they had a strike in the Cerro de Pasco mine, underground mine. And they put women, pregnant women, on the portal, because nobody could come in. And they had a group of mixture of police and army, real scumbags called the Republicans. They bayoneted these women, pregnant women, on the gate to the mine. I never want to see that again. I never want to see that again, as long as I live. And that's what I told these people, my people, the Yanacocha. We're not going to do that. I'm not going to call in the army. I'm not going to call in the police. Mm-hmm. We have to build up our own security, which we did. I didn't trust the police. I didn't trust the army. Mm-hmm. So we built our own army. Mm-hmm. One of the things was discussed in Denver. All right, how are we going to protect our people and the equipment and whatnot? People had all kinds of ideas, you know. And the president got up and he said, there's only two guys in this room that know anything about terrorism. It's Len Harris and myself. In Sumeb, terrorism reached its pinnacle. They don't wait for you to go to work and come into your house and kill your wife and children. That's real terror. Mm-hmm. That is real terror. Mm-hmm. And he said, you better find out how we're going to do this. So I got on to some people, ex-CIA people in Florida, and they put me on to a guy, a colonel, what was his name, that I took on as my consultant. Mm-hmm. We built up our own security system. I personally had six bodyguards. Mm-hmm. And we had 150 of these bodyguards at mine site. Mm-hmm. Originally, we didn't allow anybody on site. All the superintendents were armed. And, of course, as you know, they overcame the Shining Path. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like the idea very much of having them on the property, the police and the army.
The police and the army, yeah. Yeah.
The army was made up of conscripts.
Yeah.
And many of them were terrorists.
Yeah.
The police were corrupt.
Yeah.
So I formed my own army.
Yeah.
And that's how we got it going.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think some of the news reports coming out of Africa and the new kinds of security operations in sub-Saharan Africa, the criticism is that the mining companies, but also companies in general, have ceased to think in colonial terms of dominating a particular region or having some kind of collusion with a government, and have retreated to the grounds, saying that we're going to lock down this gold area or this mine in the Congo or whatever, and then we're going to hire our own private army. And it's seen it from there's a critical view of that there's this privatization of security for these corporations. And your story is a bit different, it seems. It's that your reaction was to the state fighting Shining Path was just kind of another gang. It was not to be necessarily, I don't
let
know.
Let them do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Let the government do that. That's enough for them.
Yeah.
On the table.
Yeah. Yeah. But if it results in these kinds of massacres that you saw when you were there, it's no good for the mine, it's no good for the people there.
No.
So you sought out a solution in hiring private security. You were looking for something that was a more peaceful, more cooperative solution. Certainly it was security. You had six bodyguards that were armed.
Yeah.
But
well,
there's another piece of it as well in your story.
Yeah, the other. There's no way you could really work today unless you have the approval of the community, they'll shut you down.
Yeah.
And that's the worst thing that can happen to you. Shut you down, you lose money, no?
Yeah.
And so you have to be able to work out something that you can be at peace and work in joint venture with them. Mm-hmm. My wife, during these times at the beginning when it was pretty bad, the terrorism, the women didn't come to the mine. The superintendents were confined to the mine. And they would go back to Lima to their families, whatever, 2 weeks after, 4 weeks, something like that. And so the women started to complain that they'd like to visit and see where their husbands were working. So I took a long weekend and I brought them all to the mine site. And while they were there, Rosa was always interested in helping communities. She'd been involved in this before. She was head of a group of women in the center of Peru, 600 women to work with the poor. And we had decided in the company, we had money to help the communities. But we had a lot of resistance. But once we started to wear down the resistance a bit, then she said to me, you know, there was a school nearby the mine, and we're planning to do something at the school. And she went with these women and saw these little kids literally starving. 80% of malnutrition. They didn't believe me when I said that. So I hired two doctors to go and check it out. 70-80% malnutrition. This day and age? She said, you're wasting your time, what you want to do at this school. I said, why is that? You have to feed them. Well, I don't like to get into anything poor you never get out of, you know? So we set it up. I brought a woman down from the States, anthropologist. Debbie, I said, find me the food. And she found the food through the USAID.
Right.
So then we put this system together, together with Rose's group, that we would, the company would supply the stoves, and the food would come from USAID, and the women would cook the food and give the kids one good meal a day.
Yeah.
And it worked out very well. Then they started planting garden plots at school. The USAID said, you know, if they would supply some of their own food to put in the pot, it would be easier for us to get it. So they started growing potatoes and vegetables and everything that they could put in the pot. Worked well. But I was very cautious about giving things. We later called it, Paul, a hand up, not a hand out.
Right.
And they had an old folks home there run by a Spanish nun. And I went to see the bishop, and he deliberately wanted to talk to me in this old folks home. So I did with a Spanish nun, little short nun, very, 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 very innovative. She ran a big brick plant in Cacamata. And the bishop said to me, you know, they're running a very high electrical bill here. They have a big pot, as they make a big stew every day for the old folks staying there. Costing them $1,000 a month. For electricity. And he said, maybe you could help him. I said, well, let me see, let me think about it, Monsignor. So I sent the electricians in to say, why are they using so much electricity? There's a big stainless steel pot heated by electricity. We threw it out, put in a gas-fired kettle. The electricity bill went through the floor. I paid for the pot and the installation of gas. That was into it. Now I'm out of it.
Right.
And I always worked on that type of thing. I don't want to get involved. I can never, ever get out of it, you know?
Right.
One-time deal like that worked very well.
Right.
Solved the problem.
Yep.
They were very happy. We were very happy.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
But it's been quite a transformation in my own life, because I belonged to that old school before.
Yeah.
You know, you build the mine, you pay your taxes, everything else is up to the government.
Yeah.
They don't have the money.
Yeah.
I gave a talk on this up here at Vail, and one guy got up and he said, "Why are you doing this? Isn't that the government's responsibility?" Mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, normally it is, you know. In Canada, the U.S., Australia, they supply the schooling and the food and whatever. Mm-hmm. But these countries, they're so poor, they don't have that money."
Right. Right. Well, the old attitude that you were talking about, did it, I'm guessing that some of the resistance may have been in the mining community, may have been this fear that if you give an inch, they'll take a mile.
Yeah.
Is that sense? And that kind of is implicit in your, I like to get in, but I don't want to not be able to get out. And the sense that in the negotiations that governments had with mines, they would begin a contract and they would invest and they'd have spec'd out the responsibilities and mutual obligations. And then once the mine was there, then the government would say, "Oh, now we're going to increase taxes, or now we're going to add this special duty," and the terms would change, and the mines would feel like, "Oh, this is never going to end."
That's one thing they never did improve.
Okay.
It's still the original contract which I signed, 30% tax, still is today. They asked for a voluntary donation from the mining companies to a fund to help those communities. And of course they got this deal, what's it called, where 50% of the company's taxes is returned to the region. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
A lot of money.
And that's a good deal for the mining company.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost the mining company anything, because it comes out of their tax budget, you know?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But they're really, we have to think differently, you know?
Yeah.
We really have to look for ways to do this, because the thing is getting out of control now in Peru. They stopped some, over a billion projects. There's one there, the Yanacocha, Conga, $4 billion. Mm-hmm. We'll hire 10,000 people direct. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a good thing?
Right.
Isn't that a good thing? The people voted against it.
Right.
And the guy who stirred them up is the regional president who's in jail.
Yeah.
He's in jail.
Yeah. Well, in those cases, sometimes they're worried about if it's Aboriginal people in
Amazon.
You
can see that they would be worried, too.
They're worried about their water
particularly
supply.
Particularly water.
Yeah.
You got to poison our water.
Right.
You got to steal our animals.
Yeah.
One thing I did at Yanacocha, because we had a surplus of water there, big surplus, rains a lot.
Right.
So I directed, we have a lot of water treatment plants there. Mm. I don't remember what it is today, but thousands of cubic feet per minute of treating water, which they give free to the farmers. Mm. Now when it rained, I had all the overflows directed into the water treatment plant and then to one discharge point of the property. Just one discharge point. She could control it. Mm. But, well, I don't. You have to always be thinking of new ways to do it to get the community together with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we put, where the water was discharged, I put animals there. There's no sense in telling the community of people, you know, we have water so many parts, less than so many parts of cyanide. They don't know what that is.
Right.
But I put animals there to eat and feed and drink the water.
Yeah.
And they could go and see it there, the water coming out of the plant.
There's another story. I interviewed Roshan Bapu in last March, and he told this story of people who didn't believe that the water was purified, that was clean from their operation. And so he got them to stock the reservoir with fish, and the fish were... He said, "Go test the fish." And they're like...
Well, you know, we have trouble even in this country with the water, you know. Because here in the West, in some parts of the West, the Indians have what they call water babies. The water has little babies in there. You take the water, you kill them, you destroy the babies. In Peru, the mountains are sacred. You destroy the mountain. You're taking all the mountain down. It's sacred.
Right. And so that's going back to your adage, you have to know the culture. That's the really important, and if especially if it's dramatically different from your own values, from your own ideas, you have to understand why people act the way they do and talk
to them. Changed my life that when I took my daughter to Notre Dame.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about that before. I was just thinking about death and taxes, you know. But it's true.
Yeah.
Change is another inevitable.
Yeah.
And not necessarily for the good.
Yeah.
The
only constant is change.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't that true?
Yeah. And so Rosa was your wife was a huge player in the development of this association, the Ada Minya.
Yeah.
Which is the Ladies Association of Minera Yanacocha, which was a group that facilitated education programs and health and nutritional programs and the supply of food and the construction of food food production facilities.
From donations.
Yeah.
Including donations from the company.
Yeah.
Or from the other companies too.
Right. Right.
And the contractors.
Yeah.
I mean, we couldn't make as a company, we couldn't make a deal asking the contractors for money, but she could because she's independent of the company.
Right. And it reached over 5,500 young
children.
People. 5,500 children.
Yeah.
So that had a huge impact on you. It seems like this was
an
important.
We forgot to get you. She's got a very good brochure on this.
Yeah.
I'll have to get you that brochure.
Oh, I think
how it's built up, you know.
Yeah, I think I've read some material on that. So this was a long period. This is the longest chunk of your career devoted to a single set of companies, of Newmont. So this is until 1995. And in 1995, you pass into a kind of semi-retirement. Should we call you retired? Is that fair?
I retired from Newmont, but they brought me back again as a consultant for another year.
Yeah,
and then people started. Are you aware of this company called Baird Dolbear?
Yeah, it's a consulting
group. I started working with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and because I knew them very well in New York before they moved out here. And then people started to approach me, you know, about being a director of this company, a director of that.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the companies you see there that I have been a director in the past, and for some reasons had to step down because the companies would say, one company, for example, in Colombia, where I was a director, and a proven company bought 40% of the company.
Mm.
So, of course, they would have put their people on the board.
Right.
So they asked me to step down,
but
they retained me as a consultant.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a period of extended consulting that you've been doing.
It doesn't end. I always say I'm not retired, I'm retiring.
Well, you're not retiring in another sense, so that's good. And you're chairman of Resource Development Incorporated. Is that your own company?
No, it's not my own company, no. Mm. It's owned by Deepak Malhotra.
Okay.
He owns, I'm the chairman, he's the president. I don't own it, no.
Okay.
They do give me a bonus.
Okay.
Every year.
And so you're able to give your sage advice to
them? Yeah, I do quite a bit of work with them.
Okay.
And I bring them projects from different places. In fact, you're working on one now from a Canadian company in Mexico.
And we were talking a little bit about how the industry has changed in the last 30 years. And I mean, one of the big stories is the rise of Australian and Canadian and Chinese mining companies, and the decline of the presence of U.S.-based companies. If you look back, say, 30, 40 years, you would have seen a number of American companies in the top 10 worldwide.
Yeah.
What accounts for that, in your opinion, and what can be done to sustain the health of mining in the United States?
Well, what they're doing quite a lot of is consolidation. Mm-hmm. You know, companies taking over each other.
Right.
And many of them, there's still places in the U.S. that are friendly with mining. The state of Nevada, for example, mm-hmm. you know. Right. People are still flocking into that state. Mm-hmm. I was director of another company that were about to open a gold mine there called Solitaria Resources. They have their headquarters here in Denver. But what particularly is hitting the mining industry, and particularly these days, is EPA. Mm-hmm. They're going overboard. You know, they're exceeding. You know, they're bent on shutting down the coal mines. And they really got a real war on the coal mines.
Mm-hmm.
And now if they get these further things in about regulations, they'll kill the industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's an industry that hires a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's an industry that supplies 50% of the power in the U.S. Even so, that's a big amount of power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, incidentally, how much coal supplies in California?
What percentage of the energy supply of California is supplied by coal? 50%?
Less than one.
Oh, less than 1%.
Less than one. Because they bring in the electricity from the next state or even from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
They're bringing in a lot from Canada from the Trail Smelter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy who gave a good talk on that recently. He gave all the percentages state by state. And I think overall it's 48%. But, of course, the coal companies, they just turn around and export it. But that's getting more difficult, too. Another company I'm a director of had a big coal deposit in northern British Columbia. And they got it up against all kinds of odds. They made their peace with the bands, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
They're at peace with the communities there.
Mm-hmm.
But it cost about $400 million. You have to have a partner. You have to have a Chinese partner there.
Right, right. Well, there's extensions in permitting. It's taking longer to get permits to mine, or it's no permitting at all.
Getting more and more strict.
Yeah, yeah.
More and more strict to the point that they'll shut them down.
Yeah, it's weird. It seems like there was a period of, it was initially, I'll talk about this more with some other interviewers this week, but in the 70s, it was this terrible learning process for the mining companies, because the EPA would come in and would not know necessarily how mining operates. And so they would have to teach each other sort of back and forth until they could reach a kind of equilibrium over regulation. And then in the 80s, the EPA arguably was weakened. You know, it was the regulations were more lax. But now it sounds like since 2000, when did this start to get more strict for the EPA?
With Obama coming in.
Okay.
That's exactly. Although it was already coming in, and particularly some states.
Yeah.
You know,
okay. At the state
pretty
level.
Pretty well banned mining in their states, like it is Montana's one.
Mm-hmm.
And Minnesota was, but they seem to be coming around now,
mm-hmm.
more in favor of mining. Mm-hmm. But it used to be, of course, for in my youth, miners were very welcome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they opened up mines where there was nothing there before. And some very large cities came out of mine, like Toronto is one, San Francisco is one, Melbourne, Australia is one, and there's one that they developed in South Africa called Black Mountain. Mm-hmm. Belongs now, I think, to an Indian group.
Mm-hmm.
Out of India. But it was, give me some water.
Yeah, sure.
It was developed by Phelps Dodge originally. Mm.
So in the United States, it's become more difficult to mine in many ways because of increasing regulation.
So. I had a call from a senator here, Senator Bennett, Democrat, on the phone. Obama was going to give a talk next week. He said, "What would you like to hear Mr. Obama say?" I said, "Well, I'd like him to immediately approve the Keystone Pipeline and tell EPA to get off the coal miners' back." He never answered.
Well, he asked your opinion, so.
Yeah, he asked my opinion. That's it, right. Yeah.
In your career, you've had this tremendous impact working for these many companies and with many other companies. You've also been recognized by the industry as well. So you are Mining and Metallurgical Society of America.
Gold medal, yeah.
Gold medal recipient. And you've also been involved in kind of service, professional service. Can you talk a little bit about the things that you've done and why you've been involved in?
Well, I got, I believe that we have to support those organizations and institutes that support mining, you know? And so how do you do that? Well, you have to get on committees then, try to do something. And I belong to a lot of them. Like I was telling you, this SME has been, well, since 1951.
You've been a member of SME since 1951.
Yeah. I'm a member of the Australasian, which includes Australia, New Zealand, and New Zealand, since 1943. That's even longer. And of MMSA, I joined in New York in 1973. Mm-hmm. And then I was the one that opened the section here in Denver. Mm-hmm. I started the section in Denver. And their mission is to protect the mining industry, you know? Right. They started the Brewer Mines, in fact. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Australian one. And they're all trying to do something to put the mining more in, like that paper I wrote there, the positive side of mining. Mm-hmm. People have forgotten that. Mm-hmm. All they can look at is the negative side, you mm-hmm. know, that pollution and stealing people's land and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of positives. Mm-hmm. There are negatives too. But so those institutions, I belong to them in Peru as well, the College of Engineers, mm-hmm. the Institute of Mining Engineers, and I served, in fact, I was a director of the Institute of Mining Engineers. Mm. Like the only foreigner ever was on that director. Mm. And the other group in Peru, they gave me an Engineer of the Year award. Had never given to a Peruvian before, to a foreigner before.
Right.
I find them useful.
Yeah.
They're, I think the industry doesn't use them enough.
Yeah.
The industry seems to be flying in different directions, flying under different flags.
Yeah.
They don't join together.
Right.
And it's been like that forever, and I think that's a big mistake. And the fact is they have these institutes and organizations that could do more.
Right.
Yeah? And I think SME is doing a very good job in that respect, bringing to people's attention the positive side. But it's an uphill battle, I tell you.
Well, it's interesting. Sorry.
Because we have a bad past.
Yeah.
But you see those photos?
Yeah.
That's bad. Yeah. That is very bad. I mean, we threw everything in the river or into lakes, you know. Can't do that. Mm-hmm. And it's only in recent years that has hit the miners that they need to protect the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still resistance to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's enforced not all that heavily, because by the World Bank, they just put out guidelines. Mm-hmm. Has no legal strength behind it.
Right.
But I got into an argument about this in Peru. Yeah, but we don't need them. Yes, you do. Because what's happening now is every lending institute, you have to have a clause in there, you abide by their guidelines, or you won't get any money.
Mm-hmm.
And money talks.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's been forced on them, mining, but it has to be.
Right.
There, maybe there's saturation of these things, you know,
mm-hmm.
perhaps, be more consolidated.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, they're all trying to do their best.
Yeah,
but running in different directions.
Maybe there's a lag because the big umbrella organizations seem to be U.S. based, and the mining industry.
Those
the lending institutions, but also the mining associations, the AIME and the MMSA, they tend to have a U.S. focus, even though they welcome world members worldwide. But the biggest mining companies are BHP Billiton, and so are those companies involved in MMSA? Are they involved?
Very much.
Yeah.
And some of the manufacturers too, like Caterpillar,
mm-hmm.
Kubota, and those people,
right.
are making the equipment.
Right.
Contractors and whatnot.
Right.
The is it Billiton? We had a partnership with them in Ecuador. They have very strict rules on how their people should behave, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, for instance, taking these at an exploration site,
mm-hmm.
taking in these portable potties, mm-hmm. you know? And some of the exploration geologists think it's crazy, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's the right thing to do, you know? Right. It really is.
Right.
It's all pollution of the land, and that can't have that anymore.
Right.
You just can't have that anymore.
Right.
Otherwise, you'll have everybody against you. There's from the, what I was going to say before, from the community's point of view, they're scared.
Yeah.
They hear from these radicals, there's one in there, I've got a paper there, about how they're going to poison your water, steal your cattle, steal your land, you know? That has been going on in the past, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It has. Can't do that.
Right.
Can't do that. So, the mining industry is partly at fault itself. And, you know, when I was Yanacocha, I won't mention the partners, but one of the partners said we were overdoing it on the environmental side. We were not.
He said you were overdoing it? Yeah.
We were not overdoing it. We were doing, in fact, well, with Newmont, their policy is they won't do anything less in any other country than what they expect to do in the U.S.
Mm.
And I think that's a good policy,
mm-hmm.
because we're ahead of the game here now,
right.
in spite of the fact that we have a lot of opposition from EPA.
Right.
Companies are not throwing stuff in the rivers or the lakes now,
right.
for example.
Right.
You know? They're not doing that.
Right.
And the same thing with moving people off of their properties. That's another one that's put down by the World Bank as being guidelines again. How to handle the movement of people if you want to move the township.
Right.
And we've had some good experiences with that, some bad experiences. They had a big one in Peru recently. The Chinese moved the whole town. Mm-hmm. Built a new town,
right.
A place called Chinalco, which is a big copper producer, will be bigger. And how you should act with the people, you know? And you have to go into discussion with them.
Right.
Before, you mentioned before, you know, that people would just go to the government, or the government, the Ministry of Mines.
Right.
He would approve it, that's all you needed. Not enough now.
Right.
Not enough.
Right.
So there's There's ways of doing it, but it has to be done.
Right.
And there's resistance.
Right, right. Well, Mr. Harris, I want to thank you for your time.
Hey, you're very welcome,
and
I enjoyed it.
I hope we can have some more time, because I think your career, there's more to talk about. So hopefully we'll get more time at another interview at some point in the future.
We will.
Okay.
We will, yeah. Thank you, Paul, for coming, taking your time.
Thanks. Take care.
I'll get you.